Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Our Hearts Wait, Worshiping Through Praise and Lament in the Psalms, Walter Brueggemann Library, by Walter Brueggemann. Edited by Davis Hankins. Narrated by Adam Verner. Series Preface. I have been very pleased that David Dobson and his staff at Westminster, John Knox Press, have proposed this extended series of republications of my work. Indeed, I know of no old person who was not pleased to be taken seriously in old age. My first thought, in learning of this proposed series, is that my life and my work have been providentially fortunate in having good companions all along the way, who have both supported me and, for the most part, kept me honest in my work. I have been blessed by the best teachers, who have prepared me to think both critically and generatively. I have been fortunate to be accompanied by good colleagues, both academic and pastoral, who have engaged my work. And I have been gifted to have uncommonly able students, some of whom continue to instruct me in the high art of Old Testament study. The long years of my work that will be represented in this series reflect my slow process of finding my own voice, of sorting out accents and emphases, and of centering my work on recurring themes that I have judged to merit continuing attention. The result of that slow process is that over time my work is marked by repetition and reiteration, as well as contradiction, change of mind, and ambiguity, all of which belongs to seeing my work as an organic whole as I have been given courage and insight. In the end, I have settled on recurring themes, reflected in the organization of this series, that I hope I have continued to treat with imagination, so that my return to them is not simply reiteration, but is critically generative of new perspective and possibility. In retrospect, I can identify two learnings from the philosopher and hermeneut Paul Ricoeur that illumine my work. Ricoeur has given me names for what I have been doing, even though I was at work on such matters before I acquired Ricoeur's terminology. First, in his book Freud and Philosophy, 1965, Ricoeur identifies two moves that are essential for interpretation. On the one hand, there is suspicion. By this term, Ricoeur means critical skepticism. In biblical study, suspicion has taken the form of historical criticism, in which the interpreter doubts the fictive location and function of the text, and hypothesizes about the real, historical location and function of the text. On the other hand, there is retrieval, by which Ricoeur means the capacity to reclaim what is true in the text, after due suspicion. My own work has included measures of suspicion because a grounding in historical criticism has been indispensable for responsible interpretation. My work, however, is very much and increasingly tilted toward retrieval, the recovery of what is theologically urgent in the text. My own location in a liberal progressive trajectory of interpretation has led me to an awareness that liberal progressives are tempted to discard the baby along with the bath. For that reason, my work has been to recover and reclaim, I hope in generative, imaginative ways, the claims of biblical faith. Second, and closely related, Ricoeur has often worked with a grid of pre-critical, critical, post-critical interpretation. My own schooling and that of my companions has been in a critical tradition. That enterprise by itself, however, has left the church with little to preach, teach, or trust. For that reason, my work has become increasingly post-critical, that is, with a second naivete, a readiness to engage in serious ways the claims of the text. I have done so in a conviction that the alternative meta-narratives available to us are inadequate and the core claims of the Bible are more adequate for a life of responsible well-being. Both liberal progressive Christians and fundamentalist Christians are tempted and seduced by alternative narratives that are elementally inimical to the claims of the Bible. For that reason, the work of a generative exposition of biblical claims seems to me urgent. Thus, I anticipate that this series may be a continuing invitation to the ongoing urgent work of exposition that both makes clear the singular claims of the Bible and exposes the inadequacy of competing narratives that, from a biblical perspective, amount to idolatry. It is my hope that such continuing work will not only give preachers something substantive to preach and give teachers something substantive to teach, but will invite the church to embrace the biblical claims that it can trust and obey. My work has been consistently in response to the several unfolding crises facing our society, and more particularly, the crises faced by the church. Strong market forces and ideological passions that occupy center stage among us sore tempt the church to skew its tradition, to compromise its gospel claim, and to want to be like the nations. See 1 Samuel chapter 8, verses 5 and 20. That is, without the embarrassment of gospel disjunction. Consequently, I have concluded over time that our interpretive work must be more radical in its awareness that the claims of faith increasingly contradict the dominant ideologies of our time. That increasing awareness of contradiction is ill-served by progressive liberal accommodation to capitalist interests, and, conversely, it is ill-served by the packaged reductions of reactionary conservatism. The work we have now to do is more complex and more demanding than either progressive liberal or reactionary conservative offers. Thus, our work is to continue to probe this normative tradition that is entrusted to us, that is elusive in its articulation, and that hosts a holy agent who runs beyond our explanatory categories in irascible freedom and in bottomless fidelity. I am grateful to the folk at Westminster John Knox and to a host of colleagues who continue to engage my work. I am profoundly grateful to Davis Hankins, on the one hand, for his willingness to do the arduous work of editing this series. On the other hand, I am grateful to Davis for being my conversation partner over time in ways that have evoked some of my better work and that have fueled my imagination in fresh directions. I dare anticipate that this coming series of republication will, in generative ways beyond my ken, continue to engage a rising generation of interpreters in bold, courageous, and glad obedience. Walter Brueggemann. Editor's Introduction. I began theological education just as Walter Brueggemann was scheduled to retire at Columbia Theological Seminary. I knew very little about the academic study of religion, probably even less about the state of biblical scholarship at the turn of the 21st century, yet somehow I knew enough to take every possible course with Dr. Brueggemann. After retiring, Walter continued to teach a course periodically and work from his study on campus, and he always insisted that it and any pastor's workspace be called a study rather than an office. But before he retired, during his last and my first year at Columbia, I took 6 different courses in biblical studies, including 3 with Walter. In my memory, I spent that academic year much like Saint Thecla, as she sat in a windowsill and listened to the teachings of the Apostle Paul. According to her mother's descriptive flourish, Thecla, clinging to the window like a spider, lays hold of what is said by him with a strange eagerness and fearful emotion. It was for me, as it had been for Thecla. Longtime readers, as well as those encountering Walter's words for the first time, will discover in the volumes of the Walter Brueggemann Library the same soaring rhetoric, engaging intelligence, acute social analysis, moral clarity, wit, generosity, and grace that make it so enlightening and enjoyable to learn from and with Walter Brueggemann. The world we inhabit is broken, dominated by the special interests of the wealthy, teeming with misinformation, divided by entrenched social hierarchies, often despairing before looming ecological catastrophe, and callously indifferent, if not aggressively predatory, toward those facing increasing deprivation and immiseration. In these volumes, readers will find Walter at his best, sharply naming these dynamics of brokenness and richly engaging biblical traditions to uncover and chart alternative forms of collective life that promise to be more just, more merciful, and more loving. Each volume in the Walter Brueggemann Library coheres around a distinct theme that is a prominent concern across Walter's many publications. The contents of the volumes consist of materials taken from a variety of his previously published works. In other words, I have compiled whole chapters or articles, sections, snippets for some volumes, and at times even just a line or two from Walter's publications, and sought to weave them together to create a new book that coheres around a specific theme. In this case, the theme of worship in the Book of Psalms. We have learned immensely from Walter Brueggemann's numerous publications on the content, as well as the consequences of biblical worship. Among the many biblical texts that he has considered, Brueggemann unsurprisingly focuses especially on the Psalms, about which he has written extensively. While acknowledging that Brueggemann's contributions are many and various, one can begin to grasp his influence on our understandings of biblical worship, and of the Psalms in particular, from three distinct angles. First, Brueggemann's work emphasizes the potential power contained in our language and practices of worship to construct, order, and shape the reality in which we live. Brueggemann embraces and exhorts readers to appreciate the extent to which language provides the medium that brings humans into relationship with one another in formal, composed social relations and institutions, with the crucial caveat that no particular social order is necessary, fixed, or natural. Brueggemann encourages readers to consider and be more intentional about how the language and practices of worship shape our communal relations, contribute to our ideas about God, and serve as a foundation for various values and commitments. From this perspective, worship is the arena through which communities can strive to create more justice and contribute to more flourishing in ways that better reflect the Church's understanding of the gospel. It is worth mentioning briefly that Brueggemann's analysis and embrace of the constitutive power of liturgy runs counter to certain prevailing trends in the humanities that have only strengthened in the years since he first published these ideas. Much humanistic scholarship has been devoted to placing value on particularity, celebrating instability, and privileging decomposition. In short, the ways in which systems and collectives inevitably come apart. These developments render Brueggemann's embrace of the structuring, formalizing, and constitutive power of liturgy even more important. While attention should be paid to the ways that our constructed and formalized social and political relationships can break down, involve exclusions, instill hierarchies, and so on, complete formlessness in human communities is not an ideal worthy of aspiration. Brueggemann helps us understand how and why we should analyze and appreciate the extent to which our language and liturgies build relationships, create spaces, and shape orders in ways that can be more or less deliberate, just, compassionate, inclusive, faithful, and so on. Second, and relatedly, Brueggemann is uniquely attentive to social and political dynamics related to worship and the content of the Psalms. I imagine that these parts of the following chapters may be most surprising to readers who are new to Brueggemann's work. Most of us probably do not think about religious worship as a political act, much less as a radically subversive political activity. And yet this is a central argument in the following chapters. Moreover, Brueggemann explains why he thinks that the Psalms and biblical worship are politically subversive, not only in the context of ancient Israel, but also and even especially in the contemporary context of most of his readers. The act of worshiping the biblical God inevitably entails the neglect, if not outright rejection, of alternative authorities that compete for our loyalty. And the Psalms are filled with protest, complaint, and lament, often about issues that are public, political, and economic. The Psalms articulate a pervasive public agenda to which God is inextricably linked. This public agenda unfolds dynamically over the course of the Psalms, and while it is not articulated in systematic terms in any single text, it consistently reflects a vision of the world as an interdependent place, in which all human, natural, and social formations not only depend upon God, but are also mutually conditioned. Thus, whether in lament about injustice, complaint about violence or impoverishment, or in thanksgiving for deliverance and abundance, God is entangled in the public and personal, and in human and non-human affairs throughout the Psalter. Brueggemann also shows how these aspects of the Psalms function to set into relief the social issues, policy commitments, and economic arrangements of contemporary readers. Furthermore, as developed most extensively in Chapter 9, communities that fail to provide space for the robust expression, recognition, and thus the legitimation of the dark sides of the Psalms, that is, lament, complaint, protest, imprecation, will perforce neglect, if not censure, the thorny issues and tough questions about social and political justice that underlie these expressions. Third, and finally, much of Brueggemann's work is informed by his breakthrough insight linking the findings of literary scholars about the different forms or genres of the Psalms with the philosopher Paul Ricoeur's observations about the seasonal flux of lived human experience. Ricoeur suggests that human lives tend to settle in periods of relative stability or orientation until they are inevitably disrupted by some disorienting event, out of which, eventually, we may find our lives newly oriented. Brueggemann perceives that these seasons roughly correspond to the three main types of psalms: songs of praise, orientation; lamentation, disorientation; and thanksgiving, new orientation. These seasons of life do not determine the use or efficacy of a particular type of psalm. Instead, Brueggemann suggests that seasons of orientation might incline one toward psalms of praise, disorientation toward laments, and new orientation toward thanksgiving. Incidentally, this explains my organization of this volume into three parts, following the more general introductory essays in Part 1. But one need not be in a season of disorientation to utter a lament, and the utterance of a lament can, functionally, orient an individual or community toward the life circumstances that might lead one to write or identify with words of lamentation, protest, and complaint. Brueggemann's typology is also functional in the sense that it permits us to consider how a particular type of psalm might impact individuals and communities, and, especially in Chapter 9, as mentioned earlier, how the neglect or prohibition of a particular type of psalm could have costly consequences for individuals and communities. The chapters in this book are only a sample of the many contributions that Brueggemann has made to our collective understanding of worship in the biblical tradition. They reflect and elaborate these three rather flexible areas of Brueggemann's interest, and also venture into other questions and concerns related to worship in the Bible. I hope this volume will urge readers to explore Brueggemann's work on this topic further. Even more, I hope that it will incite in readers a desire to form new social bonds through worship practices, develop richer experiences and deeper passions in any and every season of readers' lives, and energize communities of faith to recognize injustices and create and advocate for more just, healthy, and flourishing forms of collective life. Davis Hankins, Appalachian State University, Spring 2022. Part 1. Worship in the Bible. Chapter 1. Introduction to the Book of Psalms. When we come to the question of worship in the Bible, the Book of Psalms is unquestionably the indispensable starting point. The Book of Psalms, complex in its formation and pluralistic in its content, is Israel's highly stylized normative script for dialogical covenantalism, designed for many re-performances. It is complex in its formation, because the psalms seem to arise from many variant settings in diverse times, places, and circumstances. The collection of psalms, moreover, is itself a collection of sub-collections, at least some of which were extant before the book itself was formed. It is pluralistic in its content, reflecting many different sources and advocacies, so a rich diversity of theological voices is offered in it. It is highly stylized, so that there are predictable speech patterns that become, through usage, familiar. These patterns can be identified according to rhetorical genres that reflect characteristic usage. As a result, it appears that certain patterns of speech are intimately and regularly connected to certain kinds of human experience and circumstance. As a consequence, one may, with some imagination, read backward from speech patterns to social contexts. It is designed for re-performance. The Psalms offer expressions of praise and prayer that have been found over generations to be recurringly poignant and pertinent to the ebb and flow of human life. Generations of Jews and Christians have found the Psalms to be a reliable resource for the articulation of faith, but also for the authentic articulation of life in its complexity. Along with usage and worship, the Psalms have been re-performed as instruction, as the young have been socialized and inculcated into the life world of the Psalms that includes both buoyant hope and a summoning ethic that belong to this singing, praying community. The book serves dialogic covenantalism. The praise and prayer expressed therein assume and affirm that this is a real transaction. There is a God on the other end of the singing and speaking. The two partners, Israel and Yahweh, are bound in mutual loyalty and obligation. This relationship refuses both parties autonomy without responsible connection, and yet requires defining self-assertion without subservient submission. Thus, the practice of the Psalter protects the community from both religious temptations of negating the reality of God and negating the legitimacy of the life of the community. Two psalmic extremities, gratitude and praise. We may identify two stylized speech patterns that serve to voice in the congregation and in the presence of God the extremities of human experience. Many of these psalms are affirmative expressions of gratitude, offered as thanks and exuberance, and awe offered as praise. In these psalms, attention is completely ceded over to the wonder of God, who is celebrated as the giver of good gifts and the faithful, gracious governor of all reality. These speech songs constitute a glad affirmation that the center of faithful existence rests not with human persons, or human achievements, but with the God who is known in the normative narrative memory of Israel. Such hymns of praise regularly attest to God's character, as in the briefest of the Psalms. For great is his steadfast love toward us, and the faithfulness of the Lord endures forever. Psalm 117, verse 2a. The two characteristics of Yahweh celebrated here are steadfast love and faithfulness, two synonyms for Yahweh's readiness to honor covenantal commitments to Israel and to the world. Along with attestation concerning Yahweh's character, many hymns celebrate the marvelous wonders of Yahweh, wonders committed on some specific occasion, and those regularly performed by Israel's Lord. Thus, in Psalm 146, verses 3 through 9, the capacity of Yahweh to enact social transformations is contrasted with that of princes who have no energy or capacity for such transformations. The vista of Yahweh's action is as large as creation itself. But the accent of the psalm is Yahweh's commitment to the well-being of the socially vulnerable and marginal, which is to say, prisoners, those who are blind, those who are bowed down, strangers, orphans, widows, all those who are without conventional social protection. In this characterization of God, the psalm already articulates an ethical summons to God's followers that they too are to be engaged with such vulnerable and marginal persons. One of the richest deposits of such hymns of praise is at the conclusion of the Psalter, in Psalms 146 through 150, in which the particulars of psalmic praise wane, and the exuberance of praise becomes more vigorous and bolder. In Psalm 148, the singers can imagine all creation, all creatures, including sea monsters and creeping things, united in praise of Yahweh. By the culmination of the sequence in Psalm 150, there is a total lack of any specificity, and users of the psalm are invited to dissolve in a glad self-surrender that is to be enacted in the most lyrical way imaginable. Such praise is a recognition that the wonder and splendor of this God, known in the history of Israel and in the beauty of creation, pushes beyond our explanatory categories, so that there can be only a liturgical, emotive rendering of all creatures before the Creator. The gladness of thanksgiving matches the exuberance of praise, only there is much more specificity in the articulation of thanksgiving. Those who are thankful can count their blessings and identify the gifts of God. Thus in Psalm 116, the speaker can remember and recount the prayers of petition previously uttered in a circumstance of need, verses 1 through 3. The snares of death refers to some circumstance in which the speaker was left helpless. But now, after the crisis, the speaker has been delivered by God, verse 8, and is restored to the land of the living, that is, to full bodily well-being and social acceptance, verse 9. This psalm indicates that the utterance of thanksgiving is done in a liturgical setting in which appropriate action would have accompanied the utterance. Thus, the speaker remembers having pledged an offering to God if delivered, and now pays my vow, a thanksgiving sacrifice. This is an act of gratitude, and at the same time testimony to the congregation that God has indeed performed a wondrous deliverance that runs beyond all categories of self-sufficiency. Lament and complaint. The other primary genre of prayer, at the other emotional extremity, consists in lament and complaint. In these psalms, the speaker petitions Yahweh for help in a circumstance of desperate need, whereas in praise the speaker has gladly ceded self over to the wonder of God. In these laments, the speaker claims self, asserts self amid acute need, and presumes self-legitimacy in expecting God's ready deliverance. Whereas the songs of praise and thanks are dominated by the language of you, these prayers are dominated by first-person pronouns, in which the central subject of preoccupation is not God, but the needy, trusting, demanding I. Consider, for example, Psalm 77. I cry aloud to God, aloud to God, that he may hear me. In the day of my trouble I seek the Lord. In the night my hand is stretched out without wearying. My soul refuses to be comforted. I think of God, and I moan. I meditate, and my spirit faints. Verses 1 through 3. The language in this instance is intimately personal, but the genre of lament and complaint can also include public crises that concern the entire community. This may refer variously to drought, war, or quintessentially the destruction of Jerusalem. In Psalm 44, the community employs assaulting rhetoric in addressing God for being abusive and neglectful. In verses 9 through 14, the language is dominated by an accusatory you, but the us on the receiving end of alleged divine misconduct is the accent point in the psalm. All that matters is what has happened to us. The rhetoric is against God, accusing God of reneging on promises of fidelity. Two theological foci. Beyond the two psalmic extremities, two theological foci that run through the Psalter can also be identified, each of which is announced at the beginning of the book. Torah obedience and the promise of shalom. In Psalm 1, the accent is on Torah, the urgency of obedience to Torah as the promise of shalom that comes with such obedience. It is clear that this theme reflects the symmetry of the tradition of the book of Deuteronomy, the normative covenantal tradition that is derived.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?